the Enneagram 1, known as the Reformer. Ones are conscientious and ethical, with a strong sense of right and wrong. They're teachers, passionate editors, and advocates for change, always striving to improve things, but are often afraid of making a mistake. Typically organized and hardworking, they try to maintain their own internal high standards, but can easily slip into being critical and perfectionistic, mostly of themselves, but often of others as well. Their key motivations are a need to be right, to improve everything, to be consistent in their ideals, to justify themselves, and to be above reproach as to not be condemned by anyone. Welcome to the Enneagram Unplugged, the podcast where we sit down to spend some quality time with someone from each number on the Enneagram. Through questions and shared experiences, we hope that this show will leave you feeling a little more connected, encouraged, and enlightened as you continue along your Enneagram journey. We're your hosts, Ashley Danner and
Kristen Steed,
huge fans of the Enneagram, friends, and co-workers here at Christ United. Please always feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions or requests for our show.
And today, we get to sit down with Meredith McBride, the Director of Children's Ministry here at the church, and an Enneagram 1. Meredith, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yay, I'm glad to be here.
Yay.
Hooray.
First guest.
This is an easier first guest, right? Because we already talk about this stuff all the time.
Yeah, it comes up almost daily. Yes.
I think it makes life easier. I think that's why it comes up.
Yeah.
It does.
I mean, if you're really curious about your number, maybe just come by the church offices and just chat with us.
We'll diagnose you. No, we won't. That's like Enneagram number one rule. You don't diagnose other people. But
exactly. What they don't know won't hurt them. Anyways, well, thank you so much for coming on today. Now that we've mentioned that you're a one, can you give us some common knowledge around the one and how long you've been studying for and what you've been doing with it?
Sure. So I don't know if there's common knowledge, but they're called the perfectionist usually, sometimes also called the reformer. I personally like the term reformer better than perfectionist because perfectionist, I feel like, puts a lot of pressure and ones don't really like the pressure of perfection on them. So... the reformer, I feel like, is a better, more comfortable title for me. I started doing Enneagram work, oh my gosh, Ashley, when was it? 2000, oh my gosh, I don't even know what year it is right now. What is it? 2020? 2014? Yeah, that's it. So it's been about 6 years. And it started out, we did, we'd never really heard of it. And then at the church that Ashley and I used to work at, one of the pastors wanted to do an Enneagram study. And so I think I did the first round with her and that was really cool. And that was kind of my intro to it. And I was really, really interested. And then as a full church staff, we went and did an in-person full day workshop with one of the people who here in Dallas, Suzanne Stabile, who teaches, is really well known for teaching Enneagram. And again, was just completely overwhelmed by how much it helped me. And so then I just took it upon myself to do more and have led several classes, both at other churches and here, and just continue to read and grow with it. Cause I just, it's so helpful for me in how I view myself, but also it helps me to view others in a different way and not in a way that, like I said, not that I'm diagnosing other people, even though that's not the right word, but it just helps me realize, I think we all kind of fall into this trap of thinking that everyone thinks the same way that we do.
Sure.
And that is just not the case. And so it really helps me when people do things that maybe rub me the wrong way or hurt my feelings, I can look at it from a different perspective. And instead of saying, why would they do that? I have to think, well, they're not me. They think of things differently and they probably didn't even realize that bothered me. So it's been helpful.
Good point. Yes. And that's why we hope we're going to go through all the numbers during this podcast series. And we hope that you won't just listen to your own because it's really about all the relationships you have in your life. So only knowing what your number is just like one tiny bit of the whole Enneagram journey.
It's putting blinders on to the rest of the people. Yeah.
Exactly. It gives a language for a vocabulary for empathy. and some kind of more structured ways to sit back and be able to kind of sort through what's going on with your spouse or what's going on with your friend or whoever you're working with at work who is maybe not doing something the way that you think it should be done. So, Meredith, what was your journey like in discovering your number? I know that we were together through a lot of this. You did a little bit without me, but did you feel like you knew it immediately? Like, what was that experience like?
Not at all. So when I first agreed to do a study with one of my friends, I decided I was going to take the online exam. You know, there's the 20-question right. test you can take on Facebook or BuzzFeed or whatever. And the number that it gave me initially was a 7. And I read up about the 7. And I thought, yeah, I like that. That's me. I love that. Yeah. And
they're known as the enthusiasts.
It was basically what the 7 is, and we'll talk about it later, I'm sure. It's all the good parts of my personality with none of the flaws or the bad parts. And so I was like, yes, I love that. That's what I want to be. And it took a full 12-week study for me to really settle in on what I actually am. And a lot of it was me letting go of the pressure to be perfect. I said at the beginning, ones don't like that pressure because they feel it all the time. And so it was very easy for me to just say, yes, I am this number that is all the things I want to be, but not who I actually am. I think that fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, I've done a lot of counseling in my adult life. You know, we've had deaths in the family and divorces and all sorts of stuff. And so having done years of counseling, I think helped me get there quicker than some people might, just because I've had to be very introspective and I've had to, you know, really, really think to my core, what is my motivation for doing the things I do or feeling the things I do?
Right.
Maybe a little more self-aware than others. Yeah, maybe. Having done the work.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But what was hard for me to get past is just accepting the things about my number. The things that really define what my number is are the things I don't like in myself. And so that was really hard for me. And I think that's true across the Enneagram. Every class I've ever taken, every workshop I've ever done, the leader has always said in some way or form, you will know when you hear your number because you will be very uncomfortable. You never, almost never hear your number described and sit back and go, yeah, that's totally me. You know, with a smile on your face, you're usually cringing and hiding and going, oh God, please don't talk about that. I hate that about myself. So
what made what was your cringeworthy moment being a one? What made it? Because it'd be great if others were like, ah,
yeah,
you know, aha, so, that was a moment.
I've always had this perfectionist tendency, and not perfectionism with, you know, not like OCD, things always have to be clean. That's not how mine comes out. Some people's it does. Some ones, their perfectionism comes out in a cleanliness or tidiness or need to be organized all the time. But my perfectionism came out in how my life was viewed by others. So the biggest thing for me to overcome was that ones are incredibly judgmental just by nature. And they're judgmental of situations and people and everything. But more than anything, ones are judgmental of themselves. And it comes out by projecting. You know, they judge others so that they don't have to judge themselves. And the way I finally had to get to the point where I thought, I would not have been friends with teenage me. And not because teenage me was immature or all those things, but teenage me was a real jerk. I was judgy. I think I took my, you know, inwardly feeling like I wasn't good enough or I wasn't enough. I took it out on others by having this kind of, I don't know, like lied to myself. I had this holier than thou type demeanor with everybody else around me. And it just, that was my cringy moment when I heard them talk about being judgy and always judging other people. And, I don't know. I just remember like sinking in my chair and going, oh God, okay. Yeah. because it's not something I like. And I don't think there's anyone that likes judging things or people, because the biggest fear is if you're judging others, you know, they're judging you. And that's a one's biggest fear, is being judged. So, that was it for me.
Ooh. So what other aspects of your number do you feel like come out most during your everyday life or as you problem solve, or even if it's different at home or at work?
Yeah, I think at work, I think at work for me, the biggest way that I see it come out is the way that my perfectionism comes out at work is that I hyper-focus on details. Details that no one else will care about. Like, nobody else will look at that email and notice that there wasn't a semicolon, there was a period and started with a conjunction. You know, like, no one would notice that, but I'm like, oh gosh, I've got to go back and I have to edit that email again. Or, oh, we need to reshoot that entire video because my hair was flipping in a weird direction. You know, just things that nobody else cares about. And fortunately, I'm surrounded by people who I respect and I know respect me that can say, Meredith, nobody cares except for you. And I have to go, okay. So at work, I think hyper-focusing on details is the way that it comes out for me. In my life, you know, I've gotten a lot better. I think Enneagram work has really helped. Counseling has certainly helped. But one of the things I struggled with most of my, you know, teen years and my adult life is that I have the tendency to get very hung up on who or what is right. And I don't care what the outcome is. I want to know who is right or what is right. And if it's me, then you all are just in for a ride because I won't let it go.
Hear about it.
I will not let it go. So, I mean, my husband tells me all the time, he's like, Mary, let it go. And I'm like, I can't. I was right and they were wrong. I can't let it go. And it's just, like I said, I've gotten better about it. But that's in my life what I see. When I have arguments with my husband, I have to really force myself not to do the told you so thing or find a way to skew whatever the argument was about to where I was right, even when I was
wrong. Oh, so if you are wrong, yeah, how do you react when you find out you're wrong?
Terribly. Terribly. I'm very fortunate in that my husband is a very calm, level-headed guy who doesn't get, you know, he doesn't get his feathers ruffled easily. Yeah. But there have been times that I have decided, you know, whatever argument we're having or whatever thing we're debating, that this is the hill I'm going to die on. So I'm going to dig my heels in. And more than once it's happened that he proves me wrong. And he'll tell me, he's like, why are you pouting? Like, why are you pouting about this? Just let it go. I'm like, because I can't be wrong. I hate being wrong. And I hate being wrong because as a one, you just invest your everything into all of your beliefs. You know, you invest every aspect of your personality and every aspect of your heart wholeheartedly into what it is you're saying and what it is you believe. And so it's a real blow when, you know, something is proven to be wrong or someone tells you you're wrong or criticizes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Does fear of being wrong ever play into how you do things, or like, is that something you avoid or that you just really dislike at all costs? Like, do you find yourself managing that preemptively or mostly from the back end?
You know, it's weird. I don't know that I would say that I feel fear of being wrong, because usually if I'm going to invest my time or my emotional energy into something, it's because I'm 99.999% certain I'm right. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that I'm really driven by fear of being wrong. However, there are things, and something that kind of I found myself growing as an adult, and I don't know that this is necessarily because of Enneagram work, and it's probably just because of getting older, I don't pick as many battles as I used to. And mm-hmm. that probably is from having been proven wrong or having looked stupid in my mind. I'm not as quick to pick battles as I used to be, because being proven wrong or looking stupid is so just beyond, it's mortifying for anybody, but it's beyond mortifying for one. It can throw ones into real funks, and, you know, and then they'll get angry and yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, on the Enneagram, you have your main number that you spend most of your time in. But then the Enneagram explains to you that you also have a number that you go to when you're feeling, particularly secure in yourself and who you are. And then a number that you will go to when you're feeling particularly stressed. And for a one, that security number is a 7, which, you know, you initially thought you were, which mm-hmm. is that perfect version of yourself. And then in stress, you go to a 4, which is very individualistic, very creative, very feely, highly feely number. Yes. Can you share a story or an example of when you noticed you were spending time in your different numbers for either stress or security?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I love the 7s. So, and I think, you know, the older I've gotten and the happier I've gotten in my life, I spend a lot more time in my security number. I spend a lot more time as a 7 or in a 7. And for me, that what I feel is I feel calm and peace. And this is such a cheesy saying, but I feel high on life. You know, I'm just like, everything is great. My life is wonderful. I look at my kids and I'm like, I love them so much. Everything's perfect. And for me, that comes out the most when I am away from home.
No, like you're on a vacation or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, and even, I mean, my husband makes fun of me, but I love hotels. Like, I love staying in a hotel because I love that I don't have any responsibilities. I don't have to be responsible for cooking dinner or cleaning up or doing laundry or nothing. Like, I can just be and be calm and not have any pressures on me. So when I'm away from home, for the most part, is when I'm living into my 7. And that's when I'm much more spontaneous. I'm less likely to, you know, want to nitpick things or want to have a detailed list of things. I'm just like, let's go with it, whatever, let's do whatever we want. And I want to experience everything. So I think for me, I know for me, when I'm away from home is when I am the most in my 7. And the time leading up to it too. So we're about to go on our first vacation of this year, which I think most people haven't had a vacation yet this year, thanks to coronavirus. But we're going to the beach next week. And already, I mean, it's Wednesday and already I'm like all excited. And I'm, you know, my husband's like, you were in such a good mood right now. I'm like, I know, because I know we're leaving next week and I know we get to go somewhere and have fun. And I'm not going to have any responsibilities at all, except for, like, you know, making sure my kids don't kill each other. But
that's so interesting. Have you thought about how you could bring that home? Like, have you thought about how you could have that mindset more, not just when you're away?
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of the things for me is finding a way to not have as many responsibilities. As a 1, you know, the need for my house to be clean and all the stuff to be done, for our life to seem perfect, more or less, it weighs so heavily on me that I cannot be in a, you know, well, not, I don't want to say in a good mood, but I can't be carefree when there's stuff to be done. And so finding a way to take a little bit of that off of myself is, I think, the big thing. So, you know, one of the things my husband and I have talked about is we still don't have a cleaning lady. And not to say everyone has to have a cleaning lady, but we don't have one. And I've told him, you know, I think this would really help me. Just even once a month to not have to worry about, oh, on Saturday I have to spend half the day cleaning the house because I haven't scrubbed the toilets in a week or whatever. Just little things like that to take some of the pressure off would just really help most 1s, I think, relax a little more.
Not feel like everything's on your list.
Yes.
Is it hard for you to give up that control, or do you feel... Or for other 1s, is that a 1 thing at all with control, or is it pretty easy to say they could do it?
1s definitely have control issues. anybody who's met me more than once could probably tell that. But I think definitely for healthy 1s, but I think just for healthy adults in general, you have to reach a point where you realize, I have to give some stuff away. I have to give some stuff up. And so, you know, for me, a lot of that comes out at work, where I have to just relinquish the control and say, you know what, I'm going to let you guys handle that. You guys are going to do a great job. I'm going to let you do that. And at home, when it comes to things like, this is just at the top of my mind for some reason, when we were painting our house, my husband was asking me to do the, you know, the cutting in, and he would roller. And after 2 hours, I was only, you know, a quarter of the way through the room, and he was done rolling the whole room, and he was going, what on earth is taking you so long? And I just told him, I said, I can't do this. I can't, I can't do this part because I am such a perfectionist that I will sit there and if I get one little line out, I'll have to redo the whole thing. Yes. And so for me, that's an easy thing to give up. Something like, you know, painting or cleaning or something. It's easy for me to say, you know what? It's going to cause me so much stress and anxiety if I do it myself. So please just let someone else do it. And I won't nitpick it. I'll try not to. But I think that is kind of the hallmark of when people are becoming healthier, not just in Enneagram work, but in life in general. If, you know, I can't imagine an unhealthy one with all the pressure they have already, you know, it really would be like a top about to explode.
I'd also love to hear about where you go in stress, speaking of, and how that four shines out sometimes.
So yeah, the four is the very, as Ashley said, the feely number. Lots of emotions and lots of roller coaster emotions. And definitely I can tell when I am going to four. So the way that most people say that it works is when you are entering stress, you first, this is what Suzanne Stabile says, you first start behaving really, really badly in your number. So for a one, that is becoming hyper control freak about everything and nitpicking everything. And then once you get past that, in order, stress and security is a way that you care for yourself. So it's not a negative thing to go to your stress number. That is how you care for yourself. So as a one, once you have had that time where you are behaving very badly within your own number, where you are becoming a control freak and nitpicking everything to death, you go to four. And that is where you can find healing. And for me, that looks like allowing myself to just feel my emotions. Mm-hmm. And usually for me, and Ashley can attest because she's witnessed this a few times, usually for me, that means just bursting into tears, just breaking down and bursting into tears and having a real good cry, because that's something that I try to hold in all the time, is mm-hmm. that emotion. One of the things that really stands out to me, always, you know, breaking into tears, but also in stress, you feel the need to, as a one, you feel the need to be free of all of your obligations. You need to, you know, I can't have any of this pressure on me anymore. And one of the most, standout times for me was when I was in college, and there was a whole lot going on in my personal life. And that's when I first started doing counseling, and I didn't know really any of this stuff about myself yet. I hadn't really taken a journey of introspection or self-awareness. And I was working three jobs at the time to pay through school. And I was so stressed out and so emotional. And I remember I quit all of my jobs. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I quit all of my jobs. I had no plan for how
it
I was.
It wasn't just like, let's quit one and see how two does. It was like, I'm out.
I'm out of everything. I quit all my jobs. No plan for how I was going to pay rent or anything. I mean, obviously, this is not a smart thing, guys. Don't do this if you're a one. But it's how that played out for me. And so taking Enneagram classes and hearing that when they say, you know, oh, and, you know, when ones go to stress, a lot of times they have to be free of obligations. It was like a light bulb went off. And I thought, oh, my gosh. And that has been my pattern throughout my life. When things get really, really stressful or overwhelming and I'm just completely overburdened or burned out, my first inclination is to try and back out of everything. Like I close in on myself and I'm like, I don't want to be around friends. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to see anyone. I don't want to have a job anymore. I don't want, you know, I don't want to have kids anymore. I just want to be alone. Like everyone go away and leave me alone.
I imagine you in some sort of black t-shirt just listening to that, to emo songs.
Listening to
just
emo, like... You know what? I won't lie, that has happened on more than one occasion. But it is, as a one, it's the need to run away, to just run away from your problems because you're just so overwhelmed and burned out. So going to a four and allowing yourself to just feel your emotions, allowing yourself to just get them out and say them. Which is where counseling really has helped. And a lot of the work I've done, I've heard that from a lot of ones, that counseling is key because you don't have anyone else that you can just rant and rave at that aren't going to take it personally. And that's sometimes what you need to do is just rant and rave and say everything you need to say to someone who is not going to think differently of you.
Right.
Okay, so Meredith, so I know that you and Ashley have been down this Enneagram journey a little bit longer than I have. And so there's something that we talk about within the Enneagram called wounding message or childhood wounds. So I'd love if you could expand upon what a wounding message is in regards to the Enneagram and how you saw that maybe play out for the one message in your childhood.
Yeah. So, you know, the concept of the Enneagram is that we're not everybody, there's a little bit of nurture and a little bit of nature to everybody. Some people will say that everyone is born a certain number and there's nothing you can do to get around it. Others will say you're born in, you know, maybe a spectrum of numbers, like your three, your security, your stress, and your core number, and how you're raised leans you toward one or the other. I don't personally know that I have a strong opinion about it, but one of the things that they use is they talk about wounding messages or lost childhood messages. And it's essentially things that you heard as a child, not necessarily, you know, face to face or auditorially, but maybe things you observed as a child, or just somehow things that subconsciously got to you, messages that you received that shaped the way you lived the rest of your life, that really helped you kind of form within your number. So as a one, the one that I've heard the most often used is, as a one, their wounding message that they received from family, friends, anybody is essentially, you're not good enough as you are. You need to be better than what you are. And there are lots of different, you know, takes on this. Lots of people have expounded in different ways. I think one of the ones that I heard that I held true for me a little bit was that oftentimes you'll have this, if you are in a large family, where you feel like different rules apply to different people. Certain children will get away with things that you don't feel like you're able to get away with. And so those messages and those subliminal messages, you know, again, a lot of these don't have to be overt.
Right. Nor intentional by the parents. I think that's also important.
Like, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Those will kind of move you toward your number more. So feeling that, you know, rules don't necessarily apply to everyone the same makes a one hyper-focused on the rules and needing to know what is expected of them at all times. Mm-hmm. And that is what I've seen from my childhood. And I, you know, this is always so hard to talk about all the wounding messages, because if you have a good relationship with your family, you find yourself getting defensive of your family. Like,
right.
They weren't mean to me. They never said that. But, you know, again, these were not overt statements. These were not.
And we're all a number, so it's not like
right.
Any of us came out unscathed.
Right. We're not passing judgment on parents or families. But I do think so. I have four siblings. I'm the middle of five children. And my older brother is extremely musically talented. He was in Texas Boys Choir. He went to a really fancy private school for music and ended up majoring in music. My older sister is just an absolute genius, Miss Presidential Scholarship, whatnot. And then there was me, and kind of the only thing that I ever felt like I had, I don't want to say going for me because that sounds really self-deprecating, but I was kind of the goofy wild kid, which I think is, again, why I identified so much as a seven initially, because mm-hmm. I was like, no, when I was growing up, I was always so goofy and crazy and I made people laugh. That was my job. But I very vividly remember as a kid wanting to know exactly what was expected of me and not wanting to do anything until I knew it's what someone was looking for. So that was true with my family, but also when I was in elementary school, I remember I was in third grade and we had our first book report due. And, you know, as a third grader, you're looking at like, you know, one page triple spaced with 18 font. It's not like you're, you know, you're not writing a 20 page paper. But I remember going to my teacher after school and just saying, well, what do you want this to look like? And she was like, well, just write about the book. What was your favorite part? What was this? What was that? And I spent probably 30 minutes in her office just, no, please tell me exactly what you're looking for. Because I was terrified that I was going to get to school and I was going to have invested time and energy into this thing in third grade.
And
then she was going to tell me, oh, that's not what I was looking for, actually. Right. Oh, you did that wrong. Mm-hmm. So it was, for me as a kid, I did have this feeling of needing to know what was expected of me. And also, I did have the feeling that some rules didn't apply to my siblings that applied to me. And it, I always kind of felt a little bit in limbo, which I think led to a lot of my goofiness, because I was like, well, I can either be a really stoic sour kid, or I can just pretend to be fun loving all the time, even if I'm not, because I never was quite sure when something was going to cross the line, because it didn't seem like what, you know, what my brother did or my sister did, when that crossed the line, if I did it, it didn't. But then vice versa, you know, they would do something that didn't cross the line, and when I did it, I got in trouble. So there was always kind of this weird, I'm not sure exactly where I belong, so I'm just going to kind of cruise through life and hope no one yells at me and tells me I'm wrong. And that sounds horrible toward my parents, and I love my parents, and they're wonderful, so don't hear it that way, especially because my mom's a pastor, and I don't want people to be like, wait a minute, I don't want this person beating me. But
yeah, no, I empathize with that a lot, having multiple siblings as well, that it was never something that was intended. Right. I feel like parents were always just reacting to the situation at hand.
Yeah.
Trying to juggle exactly what was going on. But, you know, that ends up communicating something to the youngest child, or to the oldest child, or to the middle child, which is why I think there's all those stereotypes attached to, like, your order of birth, too.
Yes, absolutely.
That, you know, come from other places, probably.
Well, the other one that I always assumed everyone had, and, you know, a lot of Enneagram work, but also, you know, just getting older has helped me see, as a kid, I had a terrible guilty conscience. I mean, like, terrible. And a lot of that goes into, as a one, you always want to be right. And so if you do something, and not right as in correct with facts or, you know, work, but also you want to be in the right. You want to be doing the right thing at all times. And when I would do something wrong, or I'd lie, or, you know, whatever, I would have, I mean, like, I couldn't sleep. I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. And I remember as a teenager doing something that probably I shouldn't have been doing as a teenager. And I was so guilty about it. I felt so guilty that I went and confessed to my mom, and she was like, why are you telling me this? I would never have known. Why are you telling me? I was like, because I can't live with myself if I don't tell you. I have to. I have to get it off my chest. But I think a lot of ones deal with that, just supreme guilty conscience. They can't lie. They can't, you know, do a lot of wrong without confessing.
I've heard sometimes there's like a negative voice in your head, always chattering a little too loud.
Oh, the voices. So that was definitely, I think, one of my biggest aha moments that I didn't really think about when you asked it earlier until now. Yeah, the ones have this thing, and it is so difficult to describe unless you're a one, because to other people, they don't get it. Ones truly have a voice in their heads, and it's not like schizophrenia. It's not, you know, it's not something evil or horrible, but it is essentially self-talk, but not self-talk like everyone else has self-talk. And the way you can differentiate a one's voice from everyone's self-talk is that the one's voice is just horribly mean, never says anything good about you. You know, your voice never says something like, wow, you did a really great job with that. Or, huh, you know, that was actually a really good paper. You should be proud of yourself, or nothing like that. It's always how horrible you are, what a terrible mother you are, what a terrible child you are, what a this, you know, think of all the negative self-talk you've ever had in your life. And that's probably what a one deals with daily. And it can be so hard for anybody, but especially as a kid.
Yeah.
And I remember telling my mom when I was, I don't even know how old, I was in elementary school. I remember asking her, so preface to this, I was raised Lutheran, which is kind of diet Catholic. So we have a lot of talk about the devil in the Lutheran church. We don't really do that much in the Methodist church. And I remember asking my mom if the devil was in my head. And my mom, sweet mom, got all freaked out and was like, what are you talking about? And took me to see our pastor, because I think she thought I was, like, you know, hearing evil voices or something. But I was just like, no, there's always somebody in my head that's telling me what a mean person I am, how mean I am to people. And that's why no one wants to be your friend. And, you know, all these horrible things. And to my little elementary school brain, there was no other reason for that to happen except for maybe there has to be an evil force in my head. And I think, Ashley, I think you were with me when we did the workshop.
And I remember
she started talking about the ones, and she started talking about the voices. And I am ashamed but not really to admit that I just lost it. I started sobbing at the table. And I'll never forget, it got really quiet in the room. And afterwards she goes, well, does anybody else in here think they're a one? Because she certainly is. And I'm
like, oh, I am. Well, and she even said that. She even said that during the workshop. She was like, that's not surprising at all. Yeah. It's she said, whenever you talk about the voices, it's very often that a one cries.
Yeah.
Mostly because you just feel so vindicated in that, oh my gosh, not someone else deals with this too. Holy cow.
It's it's not, I'm not crazy. And someone else, I'm not the only person that deals with this, because at a certain point you do feel like what is wrong with me? Not only am I judgy and not only am I, you know, never good enough and never right enough, but then I hate myself apparently because I say horrible things in my own head. So you have this feeling of what is wrong with me? And so to hear that not only you're not the only one to deal with it, but that it's very normal for your number, it was just, I can't describe how relieving it was and vindicating. Yes, I just like it poured out of me.
That's an important note just in general about why the Enneagram can be so powerful, is it just is unlocking and you're discovering things about yourself, but also that there's these other shared experiences, like I'm not alone in these feelings.
Right.
It can be powerful as humanity.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And why it's important for other people to learn other numbers as well, because one of the most powerful things for, I think, all numbers, but especially as we're talking about ones, one of the most powerful things for me is to have someone who knows me and who knows the Enneagram to look at me and say, Meredith, that's the voice talking. Yeah. That's not reality. You know, if I go and I say, oh my gosh, I messed this up, and oh, this is horrible, and I'm just terrible at everything I do, to have someone say, okay, one, that is your voice talking. That is not who you are. And that is not what is going on. It really helps to bring me back down to myself and go, you're right. You're right. That's not me. That's not who I am. Mm-hmm. Where otherwise, as a one, you can just spiral.
Sure.
You can spiral.
Well, and I think about too, like we've got quite a few ones up here at the office. And it's, you know, sometimes as a communications director, I'm asking for certain things from people. And sometimes it takes a long time for people to get me things. But if it's someone who's typed themselves as a one, most times I'll go, oh, they're overthinking. Or, oh, they're spinning their wheels. Mm-hmm. I need to go have a conversation to let them know, A, like either clarify what needs to happen, or B, tell them it's not that big of a deal. Instead. Yeah, right. Yeah.
This was meant to be a small question.
If I hadn't known that about my ones up here, I might be like, are they just blowing me off? Like, why are they not? I've asked them, like, what is their problem? They don't care enough about me. But instead I'm like, oh no, they're caring too much. That's actually what's going on.
You need somebody that you can have some cathartic afternoon tea with every once in a while as a one.
Absolutely. Yes. Just
to do a check-in.
That is absolutely
just
true.
A small check-in. So we talked a little bit about some of those wounding messages and what you're commonly known as, but what would you say is your number's superpower? Suzanne Stabile likes to say that every number has its own super ability. And she also likes to say that your biggest talent can also be your biggest, you know, stumbling block. But what does your number allow you to do that you feel like enhances your life or the lives of those around you, and empowers you to do more?
So as I was going through, because Ashley provided me with questions ahead of time, so I wouldn't be, you know, so I would know what was expected of me.
We're not giving questions to the seven.
Knowing she was going to be, that's right, knowing she was going to be talking to a one, I appreciated that aspect. However, when I went through, I kind of jotted notes on all the questions, so I'd kind of know a little bit of what I was going to say. And this was the one that until like 5 minutes before was completely blank. Because I was like, I don't know that there's anything good about a one, which is such a one thing to do, because it's baloney, of course. But it's just, you know, it's sitting there going, well, no, I don't want to say that, because that sounds a little, you know, like I'm thinking too highly of myself, or, you know, it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. But I will say that I think the one thing I have discovered about myself and other ones is that ones are very well equipped to work very well am calmly under pressure, truly. As much as I'm loath to admit it, procrastination is my best friend because I work so well when I have a time crunch, when I've got, you know, when I'm under pressure. And it's not just working. I found that I, myself and other ones are very calm in stressful situations. We're not the ones that tend to freak out and get, you know, blubbery. It's, we buckle down. Okay, what do we need to do right now in this moment? And then sure, the blubbering comes later. But so I think that the ability to work very thoroughly and calmly under pressure is really important. I mean, we as ones tend to hyper-focus on details anyways in our everyday lives with everything we come across. So when we're under pressure, it just comes naturally to be like, don't forget the details. Don't forget this.
Yeah, because I was going to say those details too. Those are all superpowers. A lot of the best editors that we have here on staff are ones.
No, for sure. Editing is one of my favorite things to do. And not just like, I mean, obviously not for a job because that's not my job. But I love reading my mom when she was in grad school. She would send me all of her papers. And it was like a fun activity for me. It wasn't something where I was like, oh man, I've got to edit these papers. I was like, yes, I'm going to pour myself a glass of wine and get my red pen and I'm going to edit. And it was just like, it is cathartic for me. It's so much fun to be able to use the nitpicky side of my brain and use it for good, or, you know, what in some way use it for good.
Sure. I love that.
But, and I think also, so, I mean, you know, ones will never start something and not finish it. And I think that is something that ones, something really profound that ones bring to the table, especially in the work environment, but also just in relationships in general. You will never have a one start a project or start a task and either only do it halfway or not finish it. It just doesn't happen. It's like, so for a one, I have never started a book and not finished it because it would like eat away at my brain that I didn't finish something, you know, like it just, I can't do it. Even if it's a horrible, terrible book. I mean, my goodness, I read the entire Twilight series.
Oh my God.
I was like, and I can't, see, not finish
I read
it.
One, I read the first one and I loved it, but I was like, oh, I think I'm going to move on with my life.
That was enough.
Do you like a good checklist, Meredith?
I love a checklist. Oh my gosh, I love a list. And my favorite thing
is crossing
things
off. Are you Monica on Friends?
Okay, so we not that long ago, my brother was watching Friends. Oh, actually, this was long ago. This was probably 10 years ago. But he was rewatching Friends. He lived overseas at the time. Yeah, he lived overseas at the time. And so he was just kind of binging on Friends. And he called me one day and he goes, oh my gosh. And I said, what? And he said, you know who you are on Friends, right? And I just said, who? And he goes, you're Monica. And I went, I know. And he goes, you just did it. You did it. And exactly. But I say that all the time. It's terrible. I'm like,
you,
I know.
Yeah. I imagine you in the episode where they're flying over to London, where she's like, passport, check, check, check.
Yes. Yes. It's terrible. But so I think that's something that ones are always really great at, is making sure things get done. The one's never going to not finish something. But on the, like, on the spiritual side and on the emotional side of things, I think that because ones spend their lives feeling like they're not good enough, and even though we're kind of known for being judgy, ones have the desire and the want for other people to not feel that way. And so part of the reason I was asked a while ago, you know, why do you work A for a church and B for children's ministries when you love editing and you love writing and you love, you know, all that stuff. And for me, the answer was like, I don't want any child to ever grow up thinking that they are not loved and they are not good enough or worthy of love. Every single person in this world needs to know that. And I think that ones, especially when they've done self-work and they're on, you know, a healthy track, that is something that we really, really bring to our relationships and to just life with others, is the need for others to know that they are good and that they are worthy and they are loved.
Oh, it's so crazy that you said it just like that. 'Cause I'm reading this Richard Rohr book about the Enneagram for this. And that's one of the things that he says, is that although they are specifically talented in professions like bookkeeping, ones will often become teachers or pastors because they are rational, just, and balanced, which is why they make good teachers and empathetic leaders.
Yeah. I get, I wouldn't say I keep my emotions in check all the time because I'm me, and anyone who knows me knows that I cry a lot at little things. I love to cry at commercials and, you know, all that stuff. But I on Sunday mornings, I guarantee you I cry at least once a Sunday. Just watching kids, you know, in worship, or watching kids, you know, before all of this, when I could actually watch them face to face, watching kids pray and watching them smile when they hear, you know, "I'm so happy to see you." It just brings tears to my eyes, because that's all that I want, is for this whole generation of kids. I mean, everyone, but especially this generation of sweet, beautiful, innocent children to grow up knowing that they are wonderful just as they are.
I love that, Meredith. And I love that about you.
Thank you.
What advice do you have for others of your type as they're trying to reach the health of their number?
Well, I said it earlier, I think counseling is huge in some way, shape, or form. It's just so big to be able, or such a big thing to be able to have someone that you can get all of your anger, because ones have a lot of repressed anger. You know, when you feel like you're constantly not good enough and you feel like you have so much pressure, that leads to a lot of resentment and repressed anger. So counseling really helps with that, and especially with the voices, because it's so, so easy for a one to fall into the trap of thinking, "I'm the worst. I'm just the worst at what I do. I'm the worst wife. I'm the worst girlfriend," or whatever. "I'm the worst mom." And because that level of sadness and disappointment is hard to live with, oftentimes they'll counter it with being kind of like my way or the highway in their attitude with people. And so counseling and just working on yourself, becoming more introspective, meditating, those are the kinds of things that really, really help, have helped me, and I know have helped other ones, just bring a level of calm to their lives and allow them to see the positives in their personality and in their number, but also help them deal with what are perceived as the negatives.
On the flip side of that, on the opposite side of self-observation, what advice do you have for people who are in relationships or friendships with ones? What's it look like to be in a really healthy relationship with a one and helpful to them and caring to them?
Yeah. I think a big thing is learning numbers are great, but learning the person, recognizing tendencies. That's been something that's been the most helpful for me in the people that I'm in relationships with. People that know me well, you know, my husband, my friends that know me well and know, and yes, and do know the Enneagram, although you don't need to know the Enneagram to recognize tendencies, but it's more helpful when you have that shared language.
Sure.
Having those people that can say, "Hey, I feel like you're, you know, like I said, that's your voice talking. I feel like you're maybe getting a little bit stressed out. I feel like you're trying to back out of things right now. Are you, you know, are you stressed out? What's going on? How
it's almost like pulling them out of their head.
Having those people. Exactly. Having people that can pull you out of your head. I think the big thing for me romantically, or just even in really close relationships, but it comes out most in romantic relationships, having somebody, your partner, who is calm is very helpful. And not necessarily calm in their everyday demeanor, but someone that you can talk with and argue with at times, debate with, that is calm. Because oftentimes when a one is mad, they're not usually mad about what you think they're mad about. They're mad about whatever is going on in their brain. They're mad about the thing that someone told them they didn't do right. They're mad about whatever they turned in that they didn't think was done well enough. They're mad at some criticism they received, and they're letting it bubble out. And so having someone who is calm to help bring you down and get to the root of what's going on is extremely, extremely beneficial. I've been in relationships before where the other person will rise to my level. And that's just never a right. good thing for a one. It's not good for most people, but it's not good for a one. When we need de-escalation. So yeah, to have someone that can say, okay, you are very upset right now, and I love you, and I don't necessarily think what you're upset about warrants the level of upset that you are. So what else is going on here? Mm. In a calm way that doesn't seem mocking, that doesn't seem, you know, like they're criticizing you. But recognizing the tendencies and just knowing, I mean, just knowing the person is key. Helping or having the shared language is mm-hmm. really, really helpful too.
You probably already touched on this one quite a bit, but is there anything else that you would say is your favorite or least favorite thing about being a one?
Yeah. So my tendency, I was about to say, well, I'll start with my least favorite, but no, I'm going to start with my favorite thing.
Good job.
I'm trying to be healthy. I will say, I think that my favorite thing, I love that I'm good under pressure, I already said, but I think probably my absolute favorite thing about being a one is that ones are very, very focused on right and wrong and justice and injustice. Mm-hmm. And so I love that ones are, you know, we love an underdog. We love doing what's right and helping what's right. And I think one of the things that I love most about that is that by design or by definition, that means that ones cannot be horribly, horribly rigid. Because mm-hmm. even though some people might hear it and go, well, I don't know, they seem kind of rigid. If you are going to constantly be supporting what's right, that requires you to be able to hear new sides of things, new takes on things, to adjust your, you know, beliefs, to adjust your thoughts on things. And so I love that, you know, when you have a conversation with the one, for the most part, they're listening. They're taking what you're saying and they're balancing it against what they know. And ones are not the people that are going to dig their heels in and say, nope, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. They want to be right. So if someone is challenging that they're right, even though they might get irritated on the outside, they are going to go and they're going to think about it and do research and try and adapt. And I've seen that in my own life. You know, I was very much one way for a long time, politically and religiously and all sorts of things. And, you know, it just took me having conversations with people and me being around other people and reading and doing research. And I'm proud when I look back to see I've come a long way because I want to do what's right. Mm. I want there to be justice in the world. I want people to be loved. I don't really care what political party that is. I don't really care if that means that I'm an outcast. That's my focus, is doing what's right. So I like that. That makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm. That's so important right now. We need that so much. Yeah. The ability to be bendable. And yeah. to have one higher goal, right?
Right.
Rather than a million smaller goals.
Absolutely. As far as least favorite thing, I think ultimately my temper, and ones are pretty well known for their temper. Because like I said earlier, you just, you know, when you have so much pressure and judgment and voices and all that, you repress it and you continue to repress it. And then after a while, it bubbles over. And oftentimes that can come out a little explosively, and usually the person that you explode to is not the one you're even upset at. Right. So that is definitely my least favorite thing and something that I've had to really work on, and mainly with my family, because they're the ones that tend to get the brunt of it. So I've had to become very good at telling my kids, you know, I'm sorry. I did not mean to, I should not have been upset with you about that. That was not worth me being that angry. I'm sorry. So eating humble pie is something that ones do frequently. But yeah, getting fired up very easily is something that is my least favorite thing. Mm.
What do you wish people understood about being a one?
This is a hard one to answer. I was trying to think. I think that ones tend to, all numbers get a bad rap. I mean, you know, there's always going to be someone that thinks another number is not a good number. But I think mm-hmm. that ones get a particularly bad rap because they're viewed often as being like these control freak, never have any fun, very serious type of people. And I really wish people would know that underneath everything you see on the exterior is really just a person desperately wanting to be accepted and desperately wanting to be loved, flaws and all. That's the hard part, is ones can put barriers up between themselves and others because they're afraid, once people see my flaws, once they see all the mistakes I've made, once they see all these things, they're not going to value me because I'm not good enough. Mm-hmm. And so they put up barriers and they push people away at times. And so I think people view them as prickly sometimes. But underneath it all, you've just got essentially a little kid just wanting someone to have fun with and wanting someone to accept them and love them.
That's really good. That's really good insight for all of us to know. In our last question for today, what advice do you have for people that are just starting their Enneagram journey? How would you recommend they go about it? Do they take the quiz? Do they do some books? What's your advice?
I would tell people, don't do the tests. Don't do the online quizzes. If you can do a study, you know, a long study, great. If that's not in your wheelhouse or you're not capable of doing that at the moment, there are some awesome, awesome books out there. And I know Ashley mentioned the Richard Rohr book. I have one of my favorite books is called The Road Back to You. It's very good. It goes through all the numbers and
it is probably the easiest read out of all the ones I've done. I would say that would be a good place to start. Yeah.
A good starter for sure. So I like that. But I think the big thing is to know that the Enneagram is not, each number is not a standalone box. It's a spectrum. So just because you know somebody who's a one does not mean that the next person you meet who's also a one is going to be the same way. And that's where I go back to the, you know, the other personality test telling you your behaviors, not your motivations. My Myers-Briggs score is the same as Ashley's Myers-Briggs score.
That's right.
But we have very, very different motivations. Mm-hmm. We have similar behaviors in a lot of ways, but our motivations are very, very different. So don't fall into the trap of trying to define everybody by their number, because it's a spectrum.
We didn't even dive into subtypes of numbers, but it even goes deeper where, just because someone is a certain number and you don't feel like you're like them, that doesn't mean that y'all aren't the same number.
But it's just, I would highly recommend for everyone to do some level of it, if not for themselves, to help them better understand other people. I've had so many relationships in my life that I think back now and I think, oh my gosh, I was ascribing my own motivations and my own behaviors to that person and getting irritated when they didn't react the same way. And that's just not fair because everybody is so, so different. And even though we all know that at our core, duh, everyone's different, it's a lot easier when you realize just how different people are. And my favorite story to tell is one of my old coworkers, for a long time, she and I just butted heads. And there was no rhyme or reason to why we butted heads because we agreed on most things. Mm-hmm. And so we could never quite figure out where is the disconnect here. And we did Enneagram work together. Come to find out she's an eight, which I know you guys will talk about later. Mm-hmm. And I'm a one, and eights and ones are kind of known for butting heads a lot because just of the way she thinks is not the way I think. And her number is the type that would say things just really abruptly and not really think twice about the consequences of how other people would, you know, it would affect other people. And I would hear it as criticism. So then I'd get my feelings hurt and she's not thinking about it after that. So it just really helped, I think, us, our relationship, suddenly to look at each other and go, oh, that makes so much more sense now. Like, that makes so much more sense why you got upset when I did that and vice versa. So it's just so helpful to get to know other people and how they are so that you can then, instead of making snap judgments about others, see them in a different light.
That's exactly right. And I really hope that this conversation can do that for others too. And I'm so thankful for you sharing your stories with us. And we kind of have to wrap up, even though I think we would talk about this for another hour. together.
Yeah, we'll continue after hours. The after yeah, hours exactly. conversation coming
once
later.
The recording stops.
What was that on MTV? Was it MTV yeah. After Hours? Let's bring it back.
Right. Exactly. We'll have some bonus episodes. But yeah, I hope that this time has helped everybody listening feel a little more connected, encouraged, and enlightened. I know it was for me, and I've been friends with Meredith for years.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sitting down with us, Meredith, and being
Absolutely.
So open and honest with us.
Absolutely. It's fun.
Well, and to those of you out there listening and growing along with us, we're so glad to have you on this long journey with us. So until next time, I think that the reminder would be to love yourself, love others, and know that God loves you just for who you are. We'll see you soon. Bye.